Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
On WWL Radio must mean one thing, that the gourmet cellist is in the driver's seat, and it's great to be here. It's our favorite part of the day. We get to talk about wine and cocktails and restaurants and cooking and recipes and all the rest. The usual host is gone, but we have the city's favorite guest host here. It's Daniel Lalchuk, the gourmet cellist. And if all has worked out, as it seems to have, we have a very special guest joining us live on the line very late at night. I begged her to stay up. Elizabeth Minkili, are you there?
I am here, and I'm awake.
You're awake. I hope you're nestled in with a brand new ice-cold vodka martini or something of the like.
No, it's time for a grappa because I just finished eating.
It's time for grappa. Okay, good. So, but let me, I know we have very limited time. Let me just say a few things about you. A lot of people here are probably familiar with you because, as you know, New Orleans is one of the great eating cities in North America. But you've been writing about food for a long time, for the better part of 30 years. You've done a lot with photography, a lot with chronicling sort of the food scene around Italy. And as I talk to the audience here every time I'm on, saying Italy is endlessly complicated when it comes to food, and one cannot even speak of a so-called Italian food whatsoever. So you've been principally based in Rome. You have a wonderful house in Umbria as well. And in addition to writing about food, your newest book came out recently, which was Eating My Way Through Italy, which did wonderfully and continues to do wonderfully. You have another book coming out soon, so I want to talk about all of that. So
That sounds good.
You're an American living in Rome.
I am. I've been coming on and off to Rome since I was 12 years old. I grew up in St. Louis, and my parents moved here just to sort of on a whim when I was 12, 13 years old. And ever since then, I've been coming back.
And in those years, you have gone from studying 16th century architecture.
Well, I came back sort of on my own without my parents when I was a graduate student. And yes, I was researching 16th century garden architecture in Florence and figuring out how I could stay here longer than my research was taking me. And I, at the time, I was, you know, considering different options, but luckily I found my Italian husband and moved to Rome with him. And that's really when my career sort of took a turn from academia to writing for magazines and also writing books.
Now, how do you get so involved with food? Because obviously, if anybody goes to Italy, they are looking for good food. It's all over Italy. It's incredibly diverse. But did you wake up one morning and say to yourself, oh, my God, I want to be a food writer?
Not quite. You know, I've had a very, you know, close relationship with food since I was little. I mean, I, you know, had my Easy Bake Oven, and then I was cooking for my family. You know, by the time I was in middle school, I was at the library, you know, looking up recipes. So I was always cooking. I was always curious, and I was always learning. And when I sort of made the shift from academia to writing for magazines, I started writing about culture and art and architecture. But at the same time, I was writing about what I was doing day to day, which was, you know, traveling and obviously eating. And so while I was writing for magazines like Architectural Digest and Art and Antiques, I was also writing for magazines like Food and Wine and Bon Appetit and Travel and Town and Country, you know, but from a sort of that happy sort of crossroads where culture meets food. And that's how I sort of started writing about food.
And where culture meets food is something that I talk about a lot because I'm, as you know, a classical cellist, and I always say that everybody who loves music loves food, and everybody who loves food loves music. And I think nowhere better encapsulates that than Italy.
I agree.
when I lived, you know, I think you'll appreciate that when I lived in Rome in high school, My teacher was a solo cellist for I Musici, which was the most well-known Italian chamber ensemble of the past 50 years. He came from Catania, and he lived in a gorgeous apartment right off the Piazza Farnese in Via Monserrato, and I walked every day from our house, about 15 minutes away. And he said, you know what, Daniel, this is an Italian. For when I first got there, he didn't speak any Italian, really. And he didn't speak any English, so that meant we were speaking Italian. and he said, you know, cellists love food more than anybody else. And it's true. There's some truth to it, because everywhere I go in the world, all these international festivals, whenever I travel, it's always, you always find a group of cellists at the bar. Well, I forgot to mention drinking, too, at the bar and at the restaurant doing the late night. And there's a sort of conviviality that's so apparent through all of Italy. And you convey that in
your... that's one of the things that I think draws me and continues to draw me in about food, because no matter what angle you look at food through, what it really is about is meeting new people and seeing how they live and seeing how they gather around the table, you know, whether that table is a, you know, set for 20 people or whether it's like a rickety chair next to, you know, next to the side of the road where you're having a sandwich, you know, and you're finding out about something much more than what's in that sandwich. And, you know, whether you're a cellist or whether you're a ballerina or whether you're, you know, a skater or a scholar, I think that in Italy, everybody starts out the day talking about what they're going to have for lunch.
Yeah, it's actually similar to that in New Orleans. I mean, I grew up in New England, which couldn't be farther from New Orleans.
Oh, no, New England's quite different.
Quite different. And you know, the old joke about the length of a New England cookbook would be about 2.5 pages.
Exactly.
tell us a little about your latest book. I've been looking at it, and it's selling very well, actually. I'm looking at Amazon right now. It continues to sell very well, and then we'll talk about the next one you have coming up. But the latest one, Eating My Way Through Italy, just what is that book set out to do?
Well, I have really it was hard to decide what my next book was going to be. My last book was about Rome, and that was very easy for me to write because I wanted to share my favorite things to eat and do in Rome. And although I couldn't include everything since it was one city, I got to really, you know, do the highlights. But when I turned to Italy, that's a little bit harder because, as you said at the beginning of the show, Italy, it's hard to call it a country. It's more every region is its own little self-standing unity. And so trying to decide what to pick and choose and what could symbolize, say, you know, Naples, how could I talk about Puglia? How could I talk about Venice and tie that to a specific place with food and a time and recipes? And instead, I started thinking about it in a way that people travel today, because I write about travel. I have a company that does culinary tours. And I think today the biggest luxury that you can have is going someplace where you're not surrounded by a lot of tourists. And that's becoming more and more difficult in cities like Rome and Venice and Florence, you know, for good reason, because they're beautiful cities and you should come and visit. But if you really want to get to a place where you're meeting other Italians and you're having experiences that are, you know, the experiences that people have been having for hundreds of years, my feeling is that if you follow food, food will take you down that road. And so once I had this in my mind, I decided to tell the stories where that was true for me. And they just happen to be my stories, whether it's, you know, on a boat in the Lagoon of Venice, whether it is, you know, on a farm in the middle of Sicily. These are places where I was searching out something specific, food, and it took me to this place. Now, you can either follow my path or you can take it as inspiration to sort of go beyond your comfort zone in search of something to find something you didn't even know you were looking for.
Which is, I think, part of the beauty of traveling, that so many people get this sort of minute-to-minute rigid schedule in their head, and they say, we have to do this, this, this. And Italy's, I think, particularly susceptible to this kind of thing, that we have so many tourists that we have to visit. And then you finish the day, and you're like, well, what the hell was I doing? I saw the Colosseum. I saw the Spanish Steps, but I didn't eat anything worthwhile. I didn't meet anybody worthwhile. And it was this kind of sort of melange and blend of sort of just the best ofs, and actually it didn't really do much for me.
No, I agree. And the thing that's interesting to me, because you mentioned the Colosseum, is that even in a city like Rome, and you come, and of course you go see the Colosseum, but you know, today or yesterday, I spent the day in the neighborhood that borders on the Colosseum, Testaccio, and it's the old meatpacking district of Rome. And, you know, going in search of, let's say, you know, offal, you know, innards of animals, which is still, you know, which is still eaten and consumed and sold in this neighborhood. And it might not be something you think you want to go looking after. But I guarantee you, if you do, you'll discover something new. And it's not just a new taste, but you'll discover a whole new part of Roman society that is about as far from the Colosseum and, you know, standing in crowds as you can get. So it's definitely about going beyond your comfort zones, but you can get to the places, even in crowded cities like Rome and Venice and Florence, if you try.
Yeah, and, you know, you reminded me of this, about the sort of people-food relation. We lived very nearby, you'll know the name, the famous Jewish sisters who make the pizza Ibreica and the torta di ricotta.
Yeah.
What am I talking about?
Yeah, Bocconi.
Exactly.
The Jewish bakery.
Exactly. And could you give, tell listening audience what pizza Ibreica is, because it's hard to describe and it's amazingly wonderful.
It's so funny, because today we ran into friends of ours and they had a huge pack of pizza Ibreica that they were taking with them to have a snack on the train. And this is, first of all, pizza can be something, you know, we all think of pizza as, well, you know, it's something with red sauce and tomatoes on it, but pizza just means something flat in a lot of places. And so pizza Ibreica just happens to be, it looks like a big sheet of flat fruitcake, basically. and it's packed full with salted nuts like almonds, candied fruit, raisins, and they're just enough sort of dough to keep it together. And then it's baked, and it is as hard as a rock. but then you break it, and it becomes crumbly, and it's always burnt a bit because this bakery burns things. It's also known as the burnt bakery. But the thing that you've got to realize is when you start to burn sugar, it gets caramelized, so it's really good.
It's amazing.
So pizza Ibreica is this, you take a bite, you think, that's really interesting. And then you take another bite, and you cannot stop eating it because it hits that sort of crunchy, sweet, salty spot that everybody just loves.
It's incredible.
They're the only ones that make it. It's very specific to that bakery.
It's a unique thing, and I think anybody who goes to Rome, welcome to Google it. I'm sure if you do some Googling, you'll find it immediately.
Absolutely.
And it's a kind of thing where you take a bite, and then after the first bite or two, your teeth sort of get used to the hardness of the, and you're like,
exactly.
Okay, I can do this. And you feel like you have no choice.
No, I know. And it's a real secret. I mean, nobody knows how they make it. I had a friend who has a bakery in the States, and he had me FedEx him a piece of it because he wanted to sort of figure out at his bakery, you know, reverse bake it to figure out the recipe.
It's tough. I think you need you need to have the attitude of these sisters, first of all, to have it come out.
Standing on the corner having a cigarette, too, which is mostly what they're doing.
And it's hilarious because this whole fruitcake thing is like the quintessential old-fashioned WASP Christmas food. It couldn't be farther from any Jewish culinary tradition. and here I am in the Jewish ghetto in Rome eating this thing that would be amazingly Christmassy Anglican, and it's it's at the Jewish bakery.
Yeah, exactly.
So let's talk about Rome for a minute. So step back out of food and into the whole panorama of Rome. I run into people so often who say, well, I went to Italy and I went to these six cities and, oh, I couldn't stand Rome and I don't even know where to start. The normal answer, I think, is that they tried to do too much and they got overwhelmed. But what do people do wrong when they go to Rome other than not contact you for a food tour?
What they do wrong in Rome is they do it, they think they can do it in like a day and a half or 2 days or 3 days. And they spend one day at the Vatican, which is, you know, very, very crowded. They spend another day maybe at the Forum and the Colosseum, and then they're done and they've gone. And they basically, they've only seen, they've maybe been walking, they've maybe been on a bus, and they get the sense that it's crowded, it's trafficy. But Rome is a place that you have to really dedicate, I think, a lot of time to. And, you know, when we do these week-long tours in Rome, and there's a reason that I don't put our guests in a hotel. You know, we have little Airbnbs all over the place. So you get a chance to really live here. Because I think it's when you're, you know, waking up and you're making your coffee in the morning and you're looking out the window and the church bells are ringing and the birds are chirping and you know, you hear the kids rolling, you know, on their way to school. And that has nothing to do with the Colosseum. It has nothing to do with the Vatican. It has everything to do about the charm of living in Rome. And that takes time. It's, you know, you need to sit back and let it come at you. And that's something that I think people miss about Rome.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a good way of putting it. And before we get to your new book, I want to ask you, what should people do when they go to Rome? I mean, you have an app, by the way, which is available for Android and iPhone. Is that right?
It is. It's called Eat Italy.
Eat Italy is the app. And now I'm hearing some music in my ears. I'm going to beg the producer to push the break forward by just a few minutes, if he'll kindly. Mm-hmm. And he gave me the thumbs up. Great. So Eat Italy is an app. And a lot of it's free, right?
Yeah, much of it is free. I've covered about now 10 cities and regions. And the only ones that you have to pay for are Florence, Venice, and Rome, and the rest are free. There's Puglia, there's Umbria, there's Milan, Torino. And I'm adding on a bunch of other places, Naples, there'll be Sicily, the Amalfi Coast. And it's basically places to eat, and it's not exhaustive, but they're all places that I've been to, and that if you were my friend and you called me up and asked for my list of restaurants, this is the list.
Yeah, and for anybody who's afraid of the fee, I don't know how much it costs, but I can tell you, I'm sure it's not prohibitively expensive to buy Rome.
No, it's like $2.99.
Okay, so...
and that's the most expensive one. So.
Okay, so if you give up half a coffee at Starbucks, you can buy Rome on on Elizabeth McKeeley's app, which is called Eat Italy. In the last few minutes, tell us a little bit about your forthcoming book, March 2019. It'll be published, which is actually right around the pike, and it's called The Italian Table.
The Italian Table, and it's about... This is sort of the first straightforward cookbook that I've written. I write recipes all the time on my blog. I've been doing that for 10 years. And then the recipes that appear in both of my last two books. But this is really a cookbook. And what it is how to recreate certain meals that I've had in Italy. And instead of sort of doing it like a regular cookbook, which would be, you know, first course, second course, desserts, side dishes, what I've done is each chapter is a specific meal. And, for instance, there's a summer dinner in Umbria. There is a lunch by the sea in Positano. And because for me, what I wanted the chance to talk about is how do Italians act when they gather around the table? Because often when you buy a cookbook, you have a recipe, but you don't have context. And sometimes you don't know how to serve that dish to people who you're having over for dinner or for lunch, and you don't know how Italians are actually eating that. And so what I'm able to do in this book is talk about, why is this specific plate of pasta eaten only at the beach in Positano and nowhere else? Why do they eat this kind of mozzarella during that meal? And how is it served? What kind of plate is it served on? What are you doing before and after? Who are the people that are around that table? What time of year does it happen? And you know, where are these recipes coming from? And so those are the things. And so what I do in the book is, for each chapter, I provide information, not just the recipes, but the history of them. I also talk about the people who are crafting the plates, maybe the fabric that's on the tablecloth, and give a bit of the background so that when you go to make these recipes in your own home, you're getting nearer to sort of the authentic experience that I capture in the book in Italy.
And are these meals that you've actually had, or are these imagined meals?
I was actually the photographer on the book as well, and I photographed the meals as they were happening.
So there's proof that you didn't dream these up.
No food stylist. There's no spraying oil on leaves to make them pretty.
Yeah, you know that's and for all the people who haven't seen your books or your blog or your Instagram, one of the things that I think draws people to it, myself included, is that while it looks very polished and very put together, it also looks real.
It's very real, and this book is very real. So there was, you know, as I was, you know, I went to a castle outside of Rome, you know, in the countryside, and had lunch with, you know, Princess Claudia, And this was the lunch I had, and, you know, and I went in the kitchen. I photographed, you know, the cook that was cooking it. And then I photographed the food as we were eating it at the table and you know, whether the light was perfect or not. And I really wanted to capture not just the food, but the experience. Because for me, eating in Italy, yes, it's about the food. But it's also about the experience, whether you're in a restaurant, whether you're at somebody's house. And I think that often gets lost in translation into cookbooks.
It does. And I cannot tell you how many times I've had memorable meals in Italy or with Italians. I mean, I had a couple of friends from Rome visit me in New Orleans. So I had gone to high school with, hadn't seen them in 10 years plus. And they came, you know, we went to the supermarket, bought gorgeous fresh Gulf shrimp and saffron, made a wonderful shrimp saffron dish, and the passion that they have, and these aren't cooks at all, these are just normal Roman young professionals. It's sort of in the DNA, whether you like it or not.
Well, I know. I mean, this is the story that you know, when I was doing researching, eating my way to Italy, and I decided to go in search of like tortellini, you know, in outside of Modena, and I thought, you know, oh, everybody, you know, I'm going to have to go outside and talk to these ladies who are hand making tortellini and really understand what they do. I got off the train, I got into the cab, and I swear to God, within 30 seconds, my taxi driver was telling me without any prompting about the tortellini his nonna made. You know, and I said, oh, well, that's really interesting, you know, and he interrupted me. He didn't care what I was doing. I didn't get a chance to tell him I was looking for tortellini. You know, he said, and my nonna, she uses, you know, only real Parmigiano Reggiano of 32-month-old, you know, cheese.
Yeah, sure,
he was citing, he was citing the variety of the cow the milk came from to make the cheese. I mean, so people in Italy, you know, it doesn't have to be anybody that's connected with the food world. Everybody is intimately connected with the food that's on their table.
That's right. And as a way to just close all of this out, of course, we could talk for the next 25 hours. We'll do that some other time. Tell us, in a nutshell, what is a food tour with you? What does it entail, and what do you strive to do? I mean, you mentioned you don't put people in hotels. I know you do a lot of cooking. But what is the whole experience? Because I'm sure there are a lot of people who want to go to Italy, and they don't want to have to do all of the grunt work themselves. They want to have a, quote, local experience, and you're that person.
Right. So the week-long tours that we do, there's 6 nights, and we have them based in Rome, in Umbria, and in Puglia. And what we try, and I do this with my daughter, Sophie, and what we try and do is give them a little taste, the pun intended, of our life here in Italy. And so every day it's a food tour, so it's a culinary tour, so food is paramount. For instance, you know, if we're in Umbria during the right time, we go see olive oil being pressed. We go to see also ceramics being made. We have dinners at my house always. And we have cooking classes at my house, but we also go to my friends' houses, which I think is important because I want people to get a sense that they're not just, you know, going and seeing some sort of fake something that's being put on for tourists. You know, these are friends of mine who, you know, gladly open up their house, and we go to their house for dinner, or we go to another, you know, we go to my neighbor with his dogs and we hunt for truffles. We go to another neighbor who's making pecorino cheese that day. And so these are people I know for a long time usually, and I think it gives you something that you're not going to get necessarily on your own. But it'll give you sort of the tools to go off and explore.
I think that's a great way to put it, to sum it up. I'm going to give the information about how to contact you after the break. And meanwhile, we've been talking with Elizabeth Menchili, expert of Italian food, of Roman food, of Umbrian food, of Italian culture. I can't thank you enough for coming on.
Thank you so much for having me.
Ladies and gentlemen, The Food Show, WWL New Orleans, 105.3 FM, HD2. It's The Gourmet Cellist. We'll be right back. Hello, 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 and welcome back to The Food Show, 105.3 FM, HD2. And, of course, streamed all over the world, wherever the internet is found, at WWL.com. We had a great conversation, as you heard, with Elizabeth Menchili from Rome, an American living in Rome. Ever heard of that before? Never happens. I'm kidding. It's the Gourmet Cellist here, sitting in for Tom. We don't have much time left, actually, because we have a very interesting guest coming up in the next hour. So pick up the phone right now, and call 504-260-6368, 260-MENU. Call me and talk to me about restaurants you're going to lately. I had a couple of friends in town visiting last week. They had a pretty interesting experience at Galator's. But let me give you the number one more time before I tell you that experience. It's 504-260-6368. Talk to me about anything you're eating lately. I'll tell this story about Galatoire's, and maybe it will trigger some memories. It's not a good story, I hate to tell you, but it happened. So, you know, we have to report the truth here. So my friend Arthur Schwartz, who was on the show last week, came in from New York. He is a best-selling cookbook author. He hosted a food show in New York for 25 years on WOR Radio, which is one of the biggest talk show stations in New York. Best-selling cookbook author. He has a radio show now as well. A real authority. He was the executive food editor for the New York Daily News for 30 years, etc. He comes in to Galatoire's. He wanted to go on a Friday because he was going to the LPO that night, to the Louisiana Philharmonic. So I said, now watch it. Lunch at Galatoire's on Friday is dangerous because you may not get in. You may have to wait in a line. It was 90 degrees, all that stuff. So I said, try going around 3:30, 4:30. I think things will have calmed down. So he goes. There's no line. He goes up to the host stand. The host isn't even there. 3 minutes later, the host comes back, and he says, you know, we'd like a table for two. And the host says, we're very busy. It's impossible. He says, well, what about upstairs? He said, extremely busy upstairs. Okay, so I told my friend, eat downstairs in the downstairs dining room. Okay, you're very busy, he says, my friend. He goes to the host, well, do you have any idea how long it would be? Could you estimate or something? The host looks at him and he says, who do you think I am, Nostradamus? No, I'm serious, though. I mean, it in retrospect, it sounds really funny. It is a little funny. It's ridiculous. But can you imagine the host of a restaurant saying that? And my friend's response was, well, no, I didn't think you were Nostradamus, but you are the host of this restaurant, and maybe you'd have some idea as to how long it would take to get a table for two. And the guy looks away. The host just looks away and turns his back on my friend. So that was a Galatoire story that upset me because I told my friend, I said, look, it's a great place. You'll meet an authentic, you know, waiter who's been there for decades. You'll have good fresh fish and the shrimp remoulade and the crab meat maison / crab meat ravigotte and all that stuff. And who does he get? A host who looks at him and says, who am I, Nostradamus? No one thought you were Nostradamus, actually. I don't know if you get that a lot, but that wasn't what my friends or anybody else was thinking, although I can think of something else they thought you were. In any case, 504-260-6368. It's the Gourmet Cellist. I really am a cellist, by the way. And I do this when Tom is gone. And they keep calling me back for some reason. But we're having a lot of fun. The first 25 minutes was pretty interesting because we were talking about Italy with Elizabeth Menchili, who is an American living in Rome. And she was telling us all about the sort of diverse food culture in Italy, her app, Eating Italy, which is a very good app, a free app, by the way. Who doesn't like free apps as long as there's no ads? And her books, including a forthcoming cookbook. And what she was talking about, how the book focuses on meals. You see, instead of just here's recipe for X and here's a recipe for Y and here's a recipe for Z, now go have fun with the book, it recreates meals. And that really made me think a lot about the sort of times and experiences that I've had with meals. And when you think of the food, you can sort of think of the people at the same time. So we're looking for those kind of cultural experiences that you don't even know you're necessarily having when you're having them. But you look back a year later or 6 months later or 10 years later and like, oh my God, that was a really special night. And I can think of a few of those even from college. I'll talk about coming up soon. But pick up the phone and call, will you? 504-260-6368. We're going to a very quick break. We'll be back before you know it. WWL, The Food Show. Hello there. Welcome back. The Food Show, WWL Radio, HD2. That means it's high-definition audio, and you can find it in an aptly equipped car on an HD radio or even online, WWL.com. And obviously, this is Daniel the Gourmet Cellist, also as known as Dan, the gourmet cellist, if you want to save a few syllables, sitting in for Tom and wishing you'd call the following number, 260-6368, and talk to me anything about restaurants and going out and dining in, whatever. Before, we were talking about this kind of interesting link between memories and meals and people and cultural experiences. And it could be something as simple as a dinner with friends that sticks in your memory for some reason. And I'm thinking of one of those myself. I was a junior in college, and I had some friends over for dinner, and I'd just gotten this cookbook by Edna Lewis. Edna Lewis, you probably know who she was, but she was a very well-known African-American sort of pioneering chef from Virginia. And she sort of melded the traditional African-American foods with the kind of elegant English foods that are historically found in Virginia. So I'd been given a cookbook, The Taste of Country Cooking by Edna Lewis, amazingly elegant book, wonderful recipes and all of that. I hadn't used it much, but the book itself had some significance because it was actually given to me at a music festival in the summer of 2010 that came to be very important for my life. And it was given to me by my host there. They had opened up their big, large home in rural Virginia, and I was staying there along with a few other musicians. And I was admiring this cookbook. And I hadn't spent any time in Virginia at that point, and I was looking through it and sort of being brought back to a history that I didn't know. But, you know, that's the thing, too, where you can, something is vivid enough, you can sort of be transported to a place that feels familiar and feels very intimate, even though you've never been there yourself. And so they gave me the cookbook at the end of the summer and sort of sat on the shelf for years, and I didn't do much with it. And then one day I was a little bored, and I poured a cup of coffee and was sitting on the balcony at my place and probably not going to class or something. and there was this recipe that jumped out at me. It was called chicken gelatine. And I remembered that Connie, the woman who had given me the book, had told me about this incredibly rich, incredibly simple, great chicken recipe called chicken gelatine. And the only flavor in the chicken was salt and butter. I mean, that's it. So obviously you had to really have a good bird, a fresh farm, really good chicken. So I'm sitting having my coffee on the balcony. I'm reading this recipe, and I remember that Connie had told me about this. So I said to myself, you know what? It's finally time to make this recipe. So I did. So I called some friends over, and I said, look, I want to do this recipe for chicken gelatine. And my friends in college, this is at music school, by the way. As I said before, musicians are amazingly passionate about food. And I said, you know, let's make this. And they said, well, I don't know, it looks so simple. I don't know. I mean, they all love butter because, you know, we'd make these incredible sort of luxurious dishes. There was one, the chicken paprikash, that we had a Hungarian friend named Catherine, and we'd make this chicken paprikash that was loaded with butter and sour cream. But they're like, well, the chicken looks, I don't know, it's so simple. Is it going to have any flavor? A story to be continued, because we're going to go right to the phones, where Stephen awaits us. Stephen, welcome to the food show.
Hey, I'm a regular caller for Tom.
Hey, how are you?
But I'm on the bottom end of the gourmet, and I believe in country cooking and East Coast country cooking also. And I spent 30 years in the restaurant business, started at 12.
Wow.
So, but I don't like this hoity-toity. And I was raised with hoity-toity. My family is probably one of the prominent families on the East Coast, and I, as a six-year-old kid, my mother would drop me off in the kitchen and sit me in the with the French chef while they were cooking for the party that was about ready to be.
Wow, wow.
And my family also was the family that Jay Gatsby took three of my uncles, and F. Scott Fitzgerald made one person, Jay Gatsby, from four of my great uncles.
Now you're talking, sir, so you know what mint juleps are then.
Yes. So, I mean, I know a little bit of everything, but I really prefer the bottom. I would just as soon spend $12 on dinner as go out and spend $135.
Well, sure, I'm right with you. I hope I haven't implied that I'm at all hoity-toity at all. You know, this recipe I'm about to talk about, the chicken and butter, is the simplest thing in the world. But so what kind of cooking do you like to do yourself?
I do a little bit of everything, and I worked for Kay Paul for a while. Many years ago, and he turned to me one time and he said, "You have magic in your hands."
Wow.
And I don't tell many people that.
Yeah.
And when I lived on, I have property on St. Croix, and I worked for I cooked for the Catholic priests on the island. And the 6 months that I cooked for them, the cook before me cooked the same thing every week. So you knew on Wednesday it was meatloaf. And but I, in that 6 months, never cooked anything twice unless they requested it. And coming to the rectory for dinner was the hottest item on the island, including other chefs that own fancy restaurants right on the water. So, but I mean, I can do a little bit of everything.
So, have you done anything good recently, or have you been anywhere to eat good recently? And
well, I was at Revolution.
Oh,
2 weeks ago. I won a $75 gift.
Yeah, I was going to say, talk about your $12 dinner that you're so fond of.
Yeah.
$12 at Revolution will get you half an oyster.
Well, as I said to Tom, I said I ordered bread pudding. It was 3 inches long and a half an inch wide, and it was $12.
Sure, sure. Well, maybe they used those magical eggs and the magical bread that, you know, it's et cetera, et cetera, costs arm and leg to produce, but maybe not.
Yeah, but I guess my overall favorite meal is probably chicken and dumplings.
Oh, that's not very popular. I don't see that much around here.
No, it's not a New Orleans. It's a Mississippi meal and an Alabama meal and all the way up the East Coast, but not in New Orleans. And I guess you could probably get over Lafayette and you might find it, or north of Lafayette where they have more English settlers than French settlers.
Yeah, because you can find that all the way up to Pennsylvania, you know.
Yeah. Well, I'm from Delaware.
Okay, yeah, yeah.
So usually when I go home, I try to go out to a restaurant about four times when I'm there for about 10 days that has chicken and dumplings that are special. You know, the different restaurants on different days have chicken and dumplings. So
now, what can make this dish, what can make one better than another? Is it the consistency of the dumplings or the kind of stock that's used? Or
Well, the consistency of the dumplings, for one thing. And then some of them pick their meat off the bone, and some of them have it, on bone on. And my mother, for some reason, my family owned was bought out by the Underwood Chicken Spread Company many years ago. So we had a chicken company. Chicken's really big in Delaware, and I. That for some reason, my grandmother would bring home gizzards, and many people don't like gizzards.
Well, I love them.
But the one thing with gizzards, if you have to boil them for 2 hours, and then they melt in your mouth, but most people, they want to cook them for 15 or 20 minutes or just batter them and fry them, and they just do not... You know, they're not tender and melt in your mouth, but that boiled them for 2 hours. And now that I'm down here in New Orleans, I throw crab boil in when I boil gizzards.
And you don't feel like that takes over the flavor?
Well, I sort of put it in there for, you know, not for 2 hours, but maybe an hour, and then, you know, pull it out. So I find, you know, it spices it up a little bit.
I see. Well, that sounds like a pretty good idea. So next time we'll go to make chicken and dumplings, I'll boil the gizzards with a bit of the crab boil, so you have that, I don't know, that added flavor to it.
Although, you got that Hawaiian spice to it that you wouldn't otherwise.
Yeah, although sometimes I think dishes are best left without that New Orleans spice. I don't know if that's sacrilegious to say, but
pretty much everything I cook has white pepper, red pepper, and black pepper in it.
That's the Paul Prudhomme,
Yeah, if I ever opened a restaurant in New Orleans, which I haven't, I would always have white pepper and red pepper and black pepper on the table.
Well, I know Paul Prudhomme always said that he liked to layer the flavors of pepper that way, and I think it's a good idea. I do that at my house, too, and thank you so much for the call, Stephen.
Okay.
He's gone. That was Stephen talking to us about chicken and dumplings and adding crab oil and sort of making a New Orleans a twist on a dish that is distinctively not New Orleans. This is The Food Show on WWL. It's the gourmet cellist, Dan Lalchuk, here. We'll be right back. Pick up the phone, call us, 260-6368, back in a flash. Hello there, and welcome back. It's the last segment of the first hour. You know, only 2 hours now. They do the two-hour thing live, then they replay for 2 hours. So that means you have a lot less opportunity to pick up the phone and call and talk to me about everything you've been eating recently. By the way, to do that, you dial the following digits, 260-6368. That spells out the word menu, 6368. If you're not from here, you have a different area code, you add on 504-260-6368, and you'll be transferred directly over to this studio overlooking the Mississippi River, actually. It's The Food Show on WWL. We've had a lot of interesting calls today. I was talking about that sort of experience that's etched into my memory about this dish we made from the Edna Lewis cookbook, the chicken gelatine, where the only thing in it is an incredibly fresh, plump young bird, salt, and butter. And I mean a lot of butter. So I was with my friends, I told you, junior year of college. I said, we got to make this dish. And they were sort of saying, you know, I don't know, it doesn't seem very flavorful. It seems boring. And so I said, let's just do it, because Edna Lewis is a legendary cook and someone who I trusted very much from her books and her articles, and she had been so highly recommended. I said, let's just do this damn thing and see what happens. So we did. We made it, and what happens is you make it, you roast it, and then you put it on a platter, and all of the fat from the chicken and all of the extra butter, there's at least 3 sticks of butter that is included in this recipe. It sort of congeals around the chicken, hence the word gelatine. And it has its roots in a 16th century English chicken preparation. And so we did the chicken. We were sitting around. At that time, we were all drinking gin and tonics for some reason. I don't know why we were. They were good. And it was one of those nights that, you know, I'll never forget. I can look back at the pictures and the videos and everything. It's, you know, before Instagram and Snapchat. So no one was sort of publicizing it. Now, you know, when you have one of those nights, you have to show all your friends in the moment. Then, luckily, we had photos and a few videos. But it was just one of those very memorable experiences where we didn't plan on it being so, but this food kind of brought us all together in a way that I hadn't expected. And you can do this without doing a complicated meal. You can do it with your friends sitting around the table at your kitchen. Simple food, and I think that's one of the things that I want to touch on with the guest in the next hour, by the way, who's arrived, Chef Anthony Scanio of Emeril's Delmonico, and we'll get to that shortly. I want to give him his due, so we'll delve more deeply into him, into what he does, Chef Anthony Scanio, in the next hour. But meanwhile, we have a few minutes left to pick up the phone and call 504-260-6368. You know, it's actually getting to be close to the Thanksgiving season, believe it or not. It really is. I know, because I'm making plans to go to New England to have Thanksgiving with my family up there, as I always do. And I was remembering one of those Thanksgivings a long time ago. My brother and my father were living in Budapest at the time, and my mom and I were living in New Hampshire. And so it was just going to be, it was either, you know, go down to Boston and see relatives, or I never liked the food anyway, because they were some kind of vegetarian, so it was sometimes Thanksgivings were fish, and then they do all these sort of into every year was a different country. They did an Afghani Thanksgiving of all things. So it was very interesting food, but it was not what I wanted to eat at Thanksgiving. So I said, Mom, let's just do it here. So we went out to an excellent local restaurant that's no longer around. It was in the very famous Hanover Inn, which is where Dartmouth College is in New Hampshire. And we went there. We went to Zinn's, and it was just my mom and I there. And it was one of those experiences. I was very young, but I'll never forget it. We had a great meal. We had a great conversation. But how many opportunities does a kid in sixth grade get to sit at a formal restaurant with, you know, just one of his parents? One-on-one is where you really get to know someone, right? And we just talked, and that was really memorable. This kind of etched into my memory. Now, meanwhile, my dad and my brother were at an American sector-type expat Thanksgiving in Budapest, where they were served the worst food they ever had at a Thanksgiving, literally cold turkey. That wasn't nearly as bad, though, as the throngs of vulgar Dallas, Texas cowboy fans that were at the Thanksgiving. So you go to Budapest, you want a real Thanksgiving, you go into the famed building where the Thanksgiving is going to take place. The turkey's terrible. You think anything can't be worse than that. And then you're surrounded by Dallas Cowboy fans, and things suddenly got a lot worse. In any case, my mom and I did it right. We had a wonderful time. And it's those kind of small memories that stick with you. And we're going to get into that with Chef Scottio in the next hour, because little does he know, I'm not going to talk to him only about Emeralds Delmonico. I will be grilling him on food memories, his upbringing, his how he came into food. He's in for a grilling here. This is WWL Radio. You can hear the music coming on, which means that we're winding down. It's Daniel Lelchuk, the gourmet cellist. I do thank Doug, the producer, very much for solo Bach played on the cello. By the way, you know, Yo-Yo Ma has a new recording. This is it. The brand new recording of the six cello suites by Bach. It's Yo-Yo Ma playing us out. What better outro music than that? Stick with us. We have a great guest, Chef Anthony Scagno, in the next hour. It's 105.3 FM, HD2, and WWL.com. It's the Gourmet Cellist here.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.